got first. We'll take a 51 first. Let's call a meeting to order. Today is February 7th, 1983. Meeting of the Labor and Commerce House, Labor and Commerce Committee is now in session. Those members present are Representative Malone, Ringstad, Cowdery, Ewing, and Furness. We have two pieces of legislation for consideration today. The first is an act, is House Bill 51, an act limiting the adjustment of retirement benefits and providing for an effective day. Are the persons to be heard to testify? Is it Terry Craner?
Craner.
The intent of the chair is to take the hearing today. I will probably defer passage of this until we get the fiscal notes on the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Terry Kramer, the Administrative Assistant to the Blue Ribbon Commission on the State Personnel Act.
Excuse me, Terry, would you spell your last name, please, for the record?
Yes, sir. C-R-A-M-E-R. The commission sponsored this legislation because of problems we heard in testimony and that individual members of the commission have heard in their contact with retired state employees. The problem comes because with some frequency there are errors made by the Division of Retirement and Benefits or the laws or regulations change. And through no fault of a retired person, a considerable amount of overpayment can accrue over a period of 5 or 10 years. The present statutes do permit the two retirement boards, People's Retirement System and Public Employees Retirement System Board, to waive overpayments, but the statutes are limited to requiring a filing of hardship in forcing that overpayment. So the commission considered the issue and felt that the appropriate response to the situation was to say that there was a 2-year period during which errors and overpayments that should be identified and corrected, and hit members who had received too much money to be required to repay to the state that money. But that after a 2-year period of time, retired people shouldn't have to face that stress. And certainly future benefits would be corrected to the proper amount, but that they would, the past overpayment would just be raised. And that's why we're sponsoring this legislation. I'm going to be telling my
Other questions for Terry?
Basically, where the bill is laid out, we're dealing with two different sections of benefits. Basically, we're saying the same thing. Section 1 is there in Section 2.
Yeah, Section 1 is the People's Retirement System. Section 2 is the Public Employees Retirement System. And there is one difference. Because the Public Employees Retirement System also applies voluntarily to municipalities and other quasi-state agencies and entities, Section 2 does require that in paragraph 3, the printer error relates to the employee's credit of service with the state, so that this legislation would not place a burden on municipalities and other entities that have decided to join the public employees retirement system, but which did not have any control or ability to affect the state's bookkeeping system.
The effective date here, the effective date for this act is retroactive to July 1, 1979. clear period of when you can have to pay back. Why then are we going back 4 years to be retroactive?
To address at least one of the particular cases that came before the Buddha Commission. $5,000 overpayment that had had considerable steps for the commission place to make the retroactive to include her situation.
So that she will not have to pay it back because it took more than 5 years. And it took more than 2 years.
Right, it included, I forget how many, several years.
Okay, no.
The intent of this legislation is that future benefits would be adjusted, would be corrected, right?
Yes.
The current 173 provides for the adjustment. So I guess that reading this kind of context here is that it just prohibits repayments after the 2 year period is run. All of them.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't require continuing to pay any interest now. And it also prevents the
involuntary readjustment, repayment after 2 years. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Couple of questions, Terry. I think that Representative Malone hit it on the head, one that I was thinking of. How many people do we currently have in a repayment adjustment posture?
I don't know.
Is that information available?
I would think that Ken Humphreys, the director of the Division of Tax,
would be able to tell that question. Okay. Additional question? Thank you, Terry. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Money. Mr. Humphrey, would you mind addressing the letter? The question, if you'll spell your last name for the end.
Yes.
Who do you represent?
My last name is spelled H-U-M-P-H-R-E-Y-S. I'm Ken Humphreys, Director of Revision Retirement Benefits.
Thank you. As Representative Malone has again restated, the bill before us attempts to correct, I would assume, errors that have been made in the past, discovered, and an employee being forced to repay that either through, I'm assuming, direct cash or an adjustment in their benefits. The question was, there is a 4 year or a 2 year adjustment period there. How many people, well, first of all, those persons who are currently paying back, say, $100 a month or whatever, does this terminate their requirements to still make those payment adjustments? And how many people are currently affected by this and may be in some type of a deficit repayment posture?
Well, your first question is, Mr. Chairman, yes, if a person was in a repayment mode, once he had the amount that had been overpaid repaid, that's the end of it, and his benefit would go back to the normal or proper level. As to the number of people that might be in a repayment mode, I cannot answer that question precisely. I can give you my impression, and that is that it's darn few. By that I would mean probably half a dozen or somewhere in that neighborhood, but we don't have them filed that way, and it's not easily available. A remark or two that I might make, with your permission, is really, what this legislation does is that it would prohibit us, or anyone else for that matter, the board, from making the recovery. And my only concern with this is not from a tight-fisted point of view, trying to continue to the extent of some retirees. All I would suggest to you is that there is currently in existence a pretty adequate mechanism to address this problem. And my concern, if you simply prohibit the system from recovering any overpayment after 2 years, period. One thing you'll notice about the legislation is that it doesn't require that the retiree not be aware of it. The person might have been fully aware that they were being overpaid all this legislation would require is that the person not cause it. And I think you can realize pretty easily that proving that someone caused an error could be pretty difficult. And then they have allowed it to happen and that one wasn't caused. That's one concern. The other concern Ms. Kramer pointed it out, is that the current requirement is that the recovery of the overpayment does have to cause an undue hardship. And the question that I would put to the committee is, if it is not causing an undue hardship, what is the reason for not recovering? For example, you might have someone with a $40,000 a year benefit who had been overpaid $1,000. It might not cause any hardship at all. But my experience with the board in the last 3 years in these kinds of cases is that the board has been extremely liberal in waiving adjustments. And in fact, the division has been extremely liberal in recommending to the board that they do so. I think it's not such a bad idea, though, if an error is made, for the board to have a look at it. This is just prohibitive. There wouldn't be any appeal procedure. The board would not inquire into how the error had been made. You can get very quickly from an error in someone working down in the ramp to maybe something that it should be scrutinized by a board. This is my concern. I'm not at all concerned that the board would be too liberal in approving this. I just think it's not a bad idea for them to have a look at them. And also the volume that we've had is not high. I can certainly tell you how many I don't have it at my fingertips, but I can certainly report back to you and tell you how many people have appealed, for example, in the last 2 or 3 years. And then I think it might provide you with the results of those examples, and I'll be happy to do that.
Let me readjust it my sort of question. Those persons, let's say Dondo was overpaying $3,000. The basic person has paid $1,500 of that. So the passage of this legislation where the person should be required to pay the benefits of $1,500.
That's a pretty good question. And I would say offhand that the question would arise, when was the recovery of the overpayment begun? Because at that point in time, the person would have the opportunity to satisfy the overpayment in a lump sum or commence this deduction of benefits he had won. If that occurred before the effective date of the IFS extension, whatever recovery had commenced or taken place in spring, if it was after the effective date of the IFS, it wouldn't. But that would be a question for life.
Any additional questions? David?
I was wondering, you alluded that the prostate sometimes is aware of an overpayment.
That could be possible. In my experience, most mentalities are pretty careful about the size of your benefit. And generally, not always, they trust the options to resolve the case. For example, if you don't survive the options, if you have an income option, this sort of thing, and they pretty careful comparative. You have the benefit that the survivor on the issue. And all I was suggesting is that under this, a person who is entitled to a benefit of $400 per month, I don't know how that could happen, certainly, but if somehow they get the old reception doctors and he began receiving a benefit of $800 per month, then there might be some reason to believe that he had some idea that that would have been on him. This is when I'm doing small adjustments and forward, and if it just gets high, if it went 2 years, then that's it.
In that case, if you get, would that be a fraud, or would that be a disease office?
I'm not a lawyer, but when we talk with the attorney general before about this, they all they pointed out was that it's extremely difficult to prove that Texas A&M has occurred. And in any event, even if the person did know about it, that is not necessarily under the terms of this legislation to the past. He may or may not have done something positive. One of the things that he suggests here, political subdivisions are exempted. I think that they're removing the burden from them. I don't think the question of burden is the significance of the amount that we're talking about in terms of the system are insignificant. Yeah, I estimate the cost is simply the declared cost might be associated with it to be extremely small, but I think there is an important question of equity and the way you approach the difference. I think that is one of the things.
$300 a lifetime repayment, or a lump sum, or you got a I
proceeding. And I guess if you see it in detail,
I'm
said that the existing program is not that effective. Like an agent said.
Limiting the chance of error. You thought the use.
Yes, it was within the budget, and they've also.
It was in the budget, but I mean, is it totally adequate, or could it be improved? Or could you elaborate a little bit on that?
I guess there isn't a system around that can be improved. Like I was saying, I think the rate of error is really quite low. We've looked at possibilities such as preventing fraud, preventing abuses, that is to be sure that the people who are on the rolls and are going to be abused are entitled to it. One program that we instituted in the last couple of years was to have a record search where we can compare social security numbers and people going retirement benefits with the service that can check national death records, because we've heard of catches in other systems where you had some survivor perhaps cashing retirement checks of a deceased retiree. Well, we didn't really believe that was going on in the system, but we believed it was worth $1,000 or $2 to check. So we executed a contract to do that. We did that. Ran it. We found one dead person on the retirement roll out of 4,500. As it turned out, there was no fraud involved at all in this particular case, and the retirement checks for the past year and a half have been going to this fellow's brother-in-law's post office box in North Pole. And we wrote him a letter and said, "What have you been doing with the checks? I represent the case that your brother-in-law's dead, something to that effect." And he sent us all that thing. I said, 16 checks, all in thing. And the indication is that, I don't know why he was just letting them pile up there, but he certainly wasn't cashing them or attempting to misuse them. But, I mean, we do things such as that, that I think are reasonable. We have every PA double checked and initialed. We have a cross check against the computer file to see if a person has credit to service. But many of the errors that may be made in computing a person's retirement are not so much that somebody slipped a digit with the calculator, but rather that they're relying on information that may have been provided through the personnel system or through another employer about credited service, for example. And we must, in the system, rely on employers to give us credit information. So there is a possibility for errors. We've instituted field audits to try to cut down on those. And as I say, I think within reasonable bounds, we're being very successful. I'm very happy about this. I won't sit here and tell you that it couldn't be improved, because as long as you're making even more, there's a possibility for improvement.
Thank you. Additional questions that
represent
what
you
You don't have a response to Representative Malone's concern as far as the number of amount of money we're talking about, particularly in regard to that retroactive thing?
No. I like I say, it is not really the physical impact per se that I'm concerned with. It's a matter of equity and policy. It would make me feel uncomfortable in some ways if an error did occur, and that's it. You don't recover. You look at the law, it's been 2 years, it's positive, and no one sees it. The board doesn't see it. I guess the administrator would see it, but that would be all. I'm not sure it's a good idea to have that kind of thing in there. I think it's better to have your administrator, me in this case, who are acting, obliged by law to make that correction unless an oversight agency comes in and says, no, don't do that. I think you want the person that's trying to administer it and is responsible for those funds pretty well obligated to err on the side of keeping the funds safe. Now, we've, again, been, I think, very generous in recommending waivers of adjustment We have that in there. We get to go before the board, and they get to ask us, why did you make this error? And we do our best to explain to the board why we did it. And it always, if one is found, I always feel bad about it. I mean, because there's no error that ever gets made, but after it is found, you can't see a way that it could have been prevented. So we try to learn from those and say, well, we sure made one there. How did it happen? Can we possibly prevent that from happening in the future? And then the board gets to take their shot, and they do.
If there are no other questions, I'm comfortable with the answer. What I would recommend here, since we don't have the official information at this point, we have to hold the people at the station all at least a couple more days and always care for the intervention.
If we're going to be getting additional information on this, is it possible to get a copy or a list of it? How many complaints we received at the beginning of this thing? We talked about one or two complaints or 100 complaints. Or
okay. That's a couple of things that I would make note that we would request Mr. Humphrey already agreed to share with us.
That would be becoming more from the blue ribbon coming from the community of the place of the 100 complaints that we received.
I have no problem. Staff has a briefing, a presentation on this that we can take over for a second.
What you've heard is that you're satisfied, and I think it's only right that the constitutional provisions on the other side are presented. I think there's some serious constitutional questions and questions of law that are raised here. First of all, in the Article 12, Section 7 of the Constitution, it says the retirement system. Membership and employee retirement system is stated as political subdivisions that constitute a contractual relationship. Accrued benefits of these systems shall not be diminished or impaired. The question goes to one of fundamental equity. The background in the Constitution is old age with dignity. Retirement systems are established for the purpose of the people to retire, be able to count on, and be able to reasonably expect those retirement benefits for the rest of their life. In this legislation and all of this, the fundamental question that comes in is, where did the mistake occur and what are the reasonable expectations of the people who are applying for retirement? As has been mentioned, it is a clerical error. It is a promise that has been made by the Division of Retirement to these individuals. The question is then, is a question of equity. That is, for an individual who says, what am I entitled to if I retire on this given date? What will I reasonably be able to expect the rest of my natural life? The commitment is made at that time by the Division of Retirement that you will receive this amount of money. They plan their entire life based on that amount of money. I can make it. And they retire. And then down the road, well, this clerk down here made a little bit of a mistake and we didn't catch it for 5 years because our procedures are all fouled up, etc. Pay back everything. Where does that leave the individual? Where does it leave the state and its constitutional commitment not to diminish nor impair? Where does it leave an individual who is planning retirement if they have a belief that, hey, maybe that next month they'll cut that in half. Can I count on this as being a retirement? It's the belief. It's also a matter of what can people reasonably expect? There are only a few, but what is the impact on those individuals? I believe it was pointed out from the Blue Ribbon that we had a widow with $5,000 all of a sudden to be paid back. Where does that leave that individual? And this is what the question is. First of all, if the administrators in 2 years they cannot find that they've made a mistake, then they should not be allowed to come back and lower that person's level of living at that particular point in time. Under ERISA, which is federal statute for private pensions, which has been all the way to the Supreme Court, if a business agent of the union with a member of the board who, in a multi-employer trust, whether it's an employer representative or the union representative, promises or tells an individual that this is what they have coming in retirement, that is what that individual gets the rest of their natural life, regardless of the amount that it would be computed out of, regardless of their service or anything else. If that commitment is made, I believe that there are strong arguments to that our constitutional provisions could be made under this system. And again, it goes back to the fundamental equity of what is the other side of the coin and what were people promised. And this is where these people were promised this amount, they based their entire life, they made a decision to retire at this point in time based on that assumption. And now, all of a sudden, it no longer exists, and not only that, not only do they have an adjustment, maybe they have to pay this other back. 2 years is a reasonable period of time for an administrative body to pay off the case if they make it.
I think that is
I was just, you know, in your comments, raised about and you alluded to it or something like that, but it's it was a 2 year period. But in reality, regardless of the circumstances of the individual, financial circumstances, when you say that the, if they didn't have a penny, they didn't have a penny period. I mean, if it wasn't earned, so if they got a local payment, do you believe that they could the overpayment shouldn't be paid back, or how would
there are two ways of looking at the overpayment. If you're talking about that the computation say the person is 400 and you're receiving 4,000, they question the efficacy of the department of division that would allow that to occur for over a 2 year period without being able to find out. I would question the whole financial sector if they could not check money that was about 92. The second point here, if an individual, and this is the equity question, if an individual in the Constitution says, what am I entitled to? And they're told to earn an amount. And they base their entire life on that amount and keep working, withdraw from the system and retire based on that amount, then the question is it reasonable then to come back and adjust that because some quote did not do their job? What has that person been led to believe by the state?
But on the same, if they were told wrong, I mean, there's always human error. And if they were told wrong, and if they were told an error, my question is the opposition, is it still there? I would say that that's the decision that is based on this. Where is the injustice at that point? Is it the injustice of the individual believing that and retiring and not continuing on with it? Or is it an injustice that the divisions not be remembered.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper.
Yes, I wonder if the simple case has to get a question in the first time
In a 2 year period, I believe that the philosophy behind the 2 year period was, first of all, that within that reasonable they could identify that they were in mistake and make an adjustment, if need be, before the amount of tax liability was forfeited at the
time. I know this is a particular
I'm not familiar with the court case. I am familiar with
other structures that be involved in requirements for permits were arbitrary and capricious. The rules have been changed. Until we employ groups, chances of the 959 and the school district that is versus CERF for an arbitrary change in provision of the stipulated settlement, like mother wouldn't be arbitrarily rolled back credited service. But once service is granted, then they cannot come in and just arbitrarily make an adjustment. And I think that the same logic that was used in that case in drawing the federal illegal without constitutional provision, that if individuals have based their life on
believe in reading this, it's to address specific issues or individuals that have brought forward where it has impacted them, that the disruptive effect to their life, the stress that it puts them under, that they have to make an appeal before the board, they don't know what their life situation is going to be, and they have to, in essence, hold their breath. And is that right? And this is addressing saying that no, we believe that's not right, that they should not be subjected to that if they have not caused it. Now, if they had stated that they had had other service or there were other disqualifying factors or other things that they'd done, then that particular situation is not being addressed under this.
There are no other questions for the staff. Let's move on. For the sake of time, we probably should wrap this up, but as I mentioned before, the intent is to take the testimony today and postpone this until we get additional information. Mr. Manners is here representing the AEA and NEA. Do you have any comments concerning legislation, sir? So I would extend a courtesy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We really don't have a comment on this particular bill. We're not curious as to the purpose of the legislation.
Thank you. If no objection from the committee, I'd like to terminate discussion on HB 50, I believe, at this time, 51, and let's give brief consideration to 53. As you're aware, we do have full session at 10 o'clock this morning. I'll advise you as to when we'll reschedule, but a couple of things that I'd ask. We've asked Mr. Humphreys for the additional information, the number of persons, the dollar amounts involved. I would also ask the committee members, and I'll double do it myself, to read Alaska Statute 1425, 170, 173, and 175.
And
14025, mm-hmm. 170, mm-hmm. 173, and 175. There may be others. Representative Malone, are there other section of the statute you would recommend?
No, you've done. I think those are the ones that are
those are
most applicable.
I'd ask before we read, consider this again. Let's do our homework. And unfortunately, this is a Monday. Most of us had other activity over the weekend, so we're not up to speed. But I think it would be very helpful. Again, if no objection, we will terminate discussion on 51, and I'll open up. Consideration at this time for HB 53. HB 53 is an act prohibiting duplicate teacher retirement benefits for BIA service. Let's see. Person to be heard again is Terry Kramer. We have approximately, well, let's see, about 20 minutes. So I'd like to conclude that within that period of time he was trying to get 20 years old. Okay. Terry, again, would you spell your last name and who you represent?
Yes, sir. I'm Terry Kramer, C-R-A-M-E-R. I'm the administrative assistant for the Blue Ribbon Commission on the State Personnel Act, which is sponsoring House Bill 53. Briefly, House Bill 53 attempts to address a loophole which was identified commission meeting by the Division of Retirement and Benefits. A loophole is created when an individual who has worked for a BIA school system under the federal government and then also worked under the teacher's retirement system for the state government has been vested, has the possibility of being vested in both retirement systems. It's possible, as the commission was told, for the individual at the time that he or she is contemplating state retirement to ask the federal government to repay to him or her all of the contributions that he's made to the federal retirement system, cashing out that federal retirement. Then to go to the state and say, I'm ready to retire. I don't have any eligibility at the moment for federal VIA service retirement. Tell me how much I'm going to make based on that retirement. And then after the state retirement under the teacher's retirement system has been established, to go back to the federal government and say, well, I bought out all of my federal time, but now I want to pay it back, and I want to reestablish a federal retirement based on the years of service in VIA school. At that point, the person has a retirement benefit being paid on both the federal government and in the state government for the identical years of service in a VIA school. The teacher has had to pay to the state 7% of his entry-level salary to buy in to the state system, VIA federal school fund. But that 7% is not a full actuarial cost of the benefit that he would then be able to receive for those added years of service.
Yeah, so what essentially the bill does is it would eliminate the duplication of trying to take credit for service at the VIA level and then try to add it on to the state retirement program.
It says you can't get benefits from both systems for the same years of service. The present law says you are not supposed to, but the present policy is that the state asks for information about receiving federal retirement only at the time you apply for state retirement. They don't each year after retirement say, well, has anything changed? Are you now getting a federal retirement check for these years of service? And since it is possible to retire from the state without anything in the federal system and then to repay it, there is the possibility that some instances it will come up later. And so what the bill does is to say, tell us year after year, if we ask you.
And kind of a lead question from that, are you also saying that when the federal employee that's terminating the service from the federal government, that they are cashing out in one sense? Are they collecting that money from the federal government and then coming and then setting up a brand new program with the state and then going with that and then also trying to take credit for that service?
I'm not sure I'm understanding the question.
You said something about them cashing out. I got that feeling that mm-hmm. When they terminated their service from the federal government, they were actually cashing out. Am I correct there?
Yeah. Either at that point or perhaps later, they cash out their retirement contributions from the federal government, which they then have to repay at a later time to get the federal credit and benefits.
Where is the inequity occurring? Where are people trying to take advantage of it?
Well, the state statute says you can get one retirement benefit for your 5 years of employment or 10 years of employment in the VIA school system. You can choose whether you're going to get a federal benefit for those years of service or a state benefit. If you want to get a state benefit, you pay to the state 70% of your entry salary when you begin working for the state. That doesn't cover the state's cost, but the state has decided that they will add on to that so that the person can get a retirement benefit for working at the VIA school. However, the state has not been willing to say you can both get a federal bonus because for that time when you collect your federal retirement and also a state bonus when you collect a state retirement for those very same 10 years of service. You have to choose. You should get retirement for them, but you can't get both kinds of
came from Representative Kopelman and Ringstead.
Thank you. Now, I remember when these negotiations were happening and taking over BIA schools, which was some years ago, and at that time, the five-year limit was set because it was not possible to receive federal retirement for merely for 5 years of service in the federal system. So teachers who transferred over with the school either had a choice to transfer into some other BIA school or some other federal job someplace else, or coming along with the school into the state system. If they cashed out, they turned the reason at 7.5%, but then at that time it was because that was about to equal the cost of buying in for the same number of years in the state system. A considerable while ago, that's over 10 years ago. But has that changed? I mean, is it possible now to get federal retirement for nearly 5 years of service?
I believe the state statutes have changed and you can get more than 5 years of BIA service in the state system. And I don't know what the federal limits are at the time. I didn't address that.
Okay. Do you have any information indicating that this does in fact happen, or is it you're addressing a hypothetical a possibility that you want to close a loophole before it occurs?
We were advised by the Division of Retirement and Benefits that this was a problem that they perceived. Mm-hmm. We didn't ask for details about the numbers.
Okay. Yearly reporting requirement, it may not be just a problem to you, to the retired person, but to you, how much more paperwork does this generate on, or how much additional staff have you figured out, and how much, theoretically,
well,
how many additional hours of work are you going to retire for, require for the teacher's retirement system to keep up with it?
No, it's not a mandatory yearly reporting. If the division decides that there may be a problem, they can send out a letter saying, please let us know.
Okay. Any additional questions? Representative Malone?
Mr. Chairman, how many people are double dipping now?
We did not get figures on that.
Thank you. I propose that question to Mr. Humphreys, and I'll give him the ability to respond in a second. An additional question from Ms. Kramer. Thank you, Ms. Kramer.
Thanks.
I'll notify you when this is rescheduled for consideration.
Thank you.
Mr. Humphreys, would you join us again?
Yes.
Again, state your name, spell the last name, and who you represent.
Yes. My name is Ken Humphreys, HUMPHREYS. I'm director of the Division of Retirement.
Thank you, sir. Representative Malone has asked how many people, I would assume to your knowledge, are currently considered double dipping.
Are
you going to respond to that?
Yes, I believe none at this particular point in time. The section that this legislation addresses is only enacted last session. And I believe that so far we've retired no one under. A general comment, if I may, on this particular bill is that I would regard it as cleanup type legislation. It doesn't prohibit anything that isn't already prohibited. I think arguably the division probably already has the authority to go out and check to see if the person is receiving federal benefits with their child benefit. So as far as any additional administrative burden, we're talking none whatever. We have no objection to the bill because it certainly makes it clear that we have the authority to go out and perform these tests. So that's the answer. I believe probably it's designed to head off a problem before it happens that probably would have been headed off anyway.
Additional questions, Representative Malone? Additional questions? Let's conclude the hearing portion at this time. Again, we schedule this, I'll let you know, and we hope you will dispose of the legislation at that time. If there be no objection, I would adjourn the meeting at this time.
Hearing none.